Hi, welcome to the Beverage Report podcast. I'm Sarah, a third-year economics student at the LSE. Today we welcome Professor Andres Velasco, the Dean of the School of Public Policy at the LSE. Thank you so much for joining us today, Professor.
Hello, Sarah. Pleasure to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Before joining the LSE, you were the Minister of Finance in Chile. How do you find the role of an economist differs between academia and being the government, and which difference most stands out to you?
There's a sense in which they're similar and a sense in which they're very, very different. They're similar because the training you receive as an economist, or the training that I received, was helpful. It doesn't, of course, provide the answers to every question, but at least it helps you organize thinking. And of course, I was the minister during the big financial crisis 10 years ago, 12 years ago by now. And I'm a macroeconomist, and my specialty is international capital flows, interest rates, and financial crises. So what I had learned in the classroom and conducting research came very, very useful. What's different, of course, is everything else, meaning you're a minister, and that means you're in a political job, and a political job involves analysis and design and implementation of policies, but it also means, first of all, assessing a situation politically, coming up with answers, selling those answers first to the members of your government, then to, you know, to the public, to parliament, getting things passed, and getting them implemented. So aside from the analysis, there's negotiation, communication, and all kinds of other things that they don't typically teach you in economics programs. But if you come to the School of Public Policy, we'll be happy to teach you that.
What's your most memorable day in the office navigating the Chilean economy through the repercussions of the crisis?
The most memorable day is probably not the happiest day. I was the minister, had been in the job for a couple of years when the world financial crisis erupted. And one day that stands in my mind is the day that the US government went to Congress in Washington to get the big bailout package called TARP for $700 billion approved. And of course, this was all being broadcast on TV. And the first attempt at getting the program passed failed. So I had one screen on my desk with CNN, and I had another screen showing what markets were doing. And you could see that the tougher the discussion got in Congress and the more likely it was that the program would be rejected, every possible index was going south. Stock markets were going south, bond prices were going south, emerging market currencies, including the Chilean peso, were wobbly. So I spent a lot of hours that day glued to the screens, and I probably didn't get much sleep that night. There was a period there in 2008 where we all wondered, where is this going and how will it end? I used to joke with my boss, the president of Chile. I used to say to her, Madam President, when you offered me the job, you didn't tell me that it came with a crisis, right? And I have talked to other ministers who happened to be in office at the time, whether in the US or the UK or Latin America or Asia. And the one thing we all have in common is we didn't get a lot of sleep. I think during the whole financial crisis, there were months at a time when I didn't get more than 4 or 5 hours of sleep. It was very exciting, but very exhausting.
Thank you very much for sharing that with us. In your paper, The Macroeconomics of a Pandemic Minimalist Model, you highlight several unconventional fiscal policies that can keep economies in a full employment and high productivity equilibrium in the post-pandemic world. Can you talk to us about what these policies are and what makes them more desirable than conventional expansionary policies?
We wrote that paper with a couple of co-authors trying to understand why you need the unusual policies that the world has been implementing. As you know very well, Sarah, countries, big and small, rich and poor, over the last 18 months, threw the rule book out the window and did all kinds of exotic things. Some of them had been done 12 years ago during the world financial crisis, but this time it was much, much bigger. So we thought we needed a bit of a framework to think about that systematically and to understand why the policies are needed and why they have an effect. So we built a little model, you know, we economists like model, in which the core of the matter is this: because of lockdowns, firms cannot produce. But if firms fire the workers today, they will be less productive in the future. Imagine a restaurant. The owner of the restaurant has spent years finding the right chef, training the waiters, getting everybody to work as a team. The restaurant can't open. You fire them all. Well, when the lockdown ends, you will, you know, won't be as productive because you'll have to find a new chef probably and new waiters and train the new waiters. So you typically, firms want to retain workers, but they may not be able to retain workers because there's no income. There's no revenue for the firm. So the firm has to borrow. And in order to borrow, it has to guarantee to lenders that in the future, when lockdown ends, the firm will be productive. So the model, first of all, generates two kinds of anomalies, if you want to call them that. They're big multipliers. Small shocks can have very large effects. And you also have what we economists call multiple equilibria. That is to say, if lenders are optimistic, they lend. And in some circumstances, all is well. Firms survive the shock. They keep employees around. And when the pandemic ends, they're high productivity. But under other circumstances, if lenders are pessimistic, they don't lend. As a result, the firm has to fire everybody. And after the pandemic, the firm is not very productive. So the lenders say, ha, we were right. It's a good thing we didn't lend money to this firm. Look how unproductive it is. So if you have all these bad equilibria, you need policies. But they're not just demand policies. The firm's problem is, first, it cannot open, and B, it cannot borrow. So what you need, rather than a conventional demand policy, is a policy that makes liquidity available to the firm and also ensures that the firm uses that liquidity to keep the workers in place. There are different ways of doing that. You know, the furlough scheme in the UK had a bit of that flavor, but that was the government directly paying wages. That's not feasible in many countries because maybe labor contracts are not formal. So what you need is, you need to put the money in the hands of the employer and somehow direct the employer or create the incentives for the employer, first, to keep the workers employed, and secondly, down the road, to repay. So I don't want to bore you with the details, but we analyze different kinds of financial injections. It could be a loan. The government could take an equity interest in the firm. There could be loan guarantees in which the government doesn't lend the money directly, but provides the guarantee. There's several permutations, and the paper analyzes under what circumstances one may be better than another.
Following your our discussion on how, for example, the policy in the UK may not work in another country, I wanted to ask, will developing countries be discouraged from doing the same, as in following the same unconventional policies, and what's the role of international cooperation here?
It's a very, very big question and a very relevant one, because while most countries, rich and poor, developed and developing, did make a big effort during the pandemic, the definition of big varies according to how developed and rich you are. Back of the envelope numbers, which you can look at in the IMF Fiscal Monitor, suggest that developed countries, or what the IMF calls advanced economies, mounted fiscal efforts in response to the pandemic of an average of 15 points of GDP. That's gigantic, 15 points of GDP. middle-income countries, whether in South America or in East Asia or in Eastern Europe, did about half of that, 6 or 7 points of GDP on average. And low-income countries did half of the half, that is to say about 3 or 3.5 points of GDP. So clearly the ability of poorer countries to borrow was the ceiling, or to put it differently, these countries had much less fiscal capacity than the richer countries because ceilings on debt were much lower, which raises the big question, and this is an ongoing debate, as to whether institutions like the IMF did enough in the crisis. The IMF says they did more than in the past, and that's true. The IMF also says that some countries were reluctant to borrow more, which is also true. But then we have to ask the question, why are countries reluctant to borrow? What is it about IMF lending? Is it stigma? Is it bad reputation? Is it excess conditionality that kept a lot of developing countries from borrowing? Clearly, they could have used more assistance and they could have used bigger packages. If low-income countries were doing packages that were only 1/4 of the size of what advanced countries were doing, that suggests there was a constraint at work. And if you asked about international cooperation, what we need to do for the next crisis, and believe me, a next crisis will come, is to ensure that next time around, availability of funds internationally is such that low-income countries can also pursue the kinds of policies that rich countries have been pursuing this time around.
In your paper, Economic Policy Incentives to Preserve Lives and Livelihoods, you stress the importance of understanding the feedback loops between medical and economic factors. Can you explain to us what these feedback loops are and why it's so important for policymakers to understand them?
During the pandemic, governments did two kinds of things. They adopted public health policies. They said you can't leave your house, or you can only walk the dog once a day, or you can only go for a run and talk to one other person, or you have to work from home, et cetera, et cetera. So lump them all together as public health. Then governments did things that had to do with economics and finance. They subsidized businesses, they paid firms wages, they handed out cash to households, and all of that involves cash. The question we asked in that paper is, how should we think of these policies together? I'll give you one example. It is not enough to tell people to stay home. People need the incentives to stay home. Unless you have a police state, people may violate the rules. And we know that plenty of people, including the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, seem to have violated the rules. And we know from mobility data, you know, you can use Google data or other equivalent data, that in many countries, violation of these rules was rampant. So there's a subtle interaction between the rules governing lockdowns, for instance, and economic incentives. For instance, the more direct money to households there is, the more inclined firms will be to allow workers to stay home, and the more inclined workers will be to stay home because they know they're not losing the jobs. There's also an interaction between today's income, today's rules, and tomorrow's incomes. I'll give you an example. If workers believe that the pandemic and the lockdown is going to be short-lived and that the economy will roar back afterwards, well, people will say, fine, you know, I will stay home for a month or two, I will eat into my savings, but I don't care because at the end I will have a job and the job will be well paid. However, if people come to be pessimistic about the prospects for the economy, and if people say, oh my God, after the pandemic ends, I won't have a job, well, they will not stay home because their savings are limited. And by the time the lockdown ends, they will have no savings and they will have no job. And as a result, people are more likely to go out and look for a job or keep on working informally, for instance, in a developing country, even though the government is saying there is a lockdown and stay home. So there are many feedback loops They all involve incentives. They all involve expectations. But the basic point they make from a policymaker's point of view is that you need to design the package all at once. That is to say, what you decide on the public health front and what you decide on the economics, subsidies and transfers front must be interconnected. And in many countries, it didn't happen that way. The public health people tended to be doctors that were doing their bit. The fiscal people tended to be economists that were doing their bit. And the two sides sometimes did not connect. And this meant probably that policies could have been better, they could have been more effective, and conceivably also they could have been cheaper in terms of lockdown times and also in terms of the total cost of subsidies.
The pandemic also makes us rethink the role of states. And my question is, in which areas of economic life do you think the state should involve in itself in a bit more? And does this necessitate a structural shift in the dynamic between the state and the free market economies?
I am not one to describe the world as a constant fight between markets and states. I think that way of looking at the world has created a lot of tension, but not necessarily a lot of illumination. There are some areas where the state needs to be bigger. There are some areas where the state maybe needs to be smaller or more efficient. So at that level of abstraction, it's hard to provide a very useful answer. But I think if you dig a little deeper and focus on specifics, we were reminded by the pandemic that there are some areas where the state has to be not only muscular, but also very active. Welfare states, you know, this is the beverage podcast, so welfare states should be in the middle of what we discuss, are about social insurance. And social insurance is about transferring income or providing services to citizens during hard times. And the big question, I think, is how well did states turn out to behave when it came to providing insurance? And of course, there's a broad range of experience. Rich countries, poor countries in the south and in the north, but there are two or three things where perhaps we could have done better. And I'm thinking not only of the UK or the US, but also developing countries. One area, this is really very basic, but sometimes basics matter a lot. In some countries, governments have very good listings of everybody. So if my household or yours are in trouble, I lost my job, you lost your job, they can wire money right away. But that requires that they need your, you know, they need to know who you are, where you live, and very crucially, you need a checking account. In some developing countries, almost everybody has a checking account. In some developing countries, almost no one has a checking account. So national roles, informational systems, and access to accounts prove to be absolutely key. This sounds very trivial, but it isn't. I'll give you one example. In Peru, the government spent a great deal of money, nearly 8 points of GDP. But one problem is that many Peruvians don't have bank accounts. So in order to give the households the money, Peruvians had to line up outside a bank. And guess what happened? Many got the virus while queuing up. And that's probably not the best of policies. A second very mechanical and trivial thing has to do with the degree of formality or informality in the labor market. I don't mean this is trivial in the big scheme of things. It's absolutely key. What I mean to say that this is kind of mechanical. In the UK or in Denmark or in Germany, the government could provide subsidies to wages or furloughs because most jobs involve a formal contract. You know, I teach at the LSE and I have a contract and I have a pre-specified wage. In a lot of countries, 40%, 50%, 60%, 70% of the labor force works informally. And this creates big obstacles for the government to step in because the government cannot say, I will subsidize 30% of your wage because you don't have a wage. There's no pre-specified wage because there's no formal contract. So I could go on, but I guess the basic message here is that in many countries, the sort of basics of the functioning of the labor market and the basics of the welfare state are absent. Listings of where people are, electronic access to people, the existence of broad-based banking systems in which even low-income households have a bank account. It can be a very simple checking account or current account, doesn't have to be fancy. Those things seem to have made a very, very big difference. And of course, last but not least, you need fiscal space. It is not enough to say that governments have to be larger. In order to be larger in bad times, governments have to be smaller in good times. Or to put it more ideologically, if governments are going to be Keynesian, which I think they ought to be, and stimulate demand and transfer resources to households in bad times, governments will dissave and typically run a deficit in bad times. Over the cycle, they have to save at some other time. They have to save in good times. And that means that you need a more active government policy, both on the low side of the cycle and the high and prosperous side of the cycle. And that is something that often is forgotten. People think about the spending in the bad times. They don't think about where the resources will come from, and they have to come mostly through savings in good times.
As the Dean of the School of Public Policy at LSE, I'm sure you're aware, there's a large group of aspiring policymakers here. Who would be the one piece of advice that you'd like to give?
I'll make it two, if I may. One is take your economics seriously. It will come in handy. My second piece of advice is don't stop at economics alone. Being a good economist, having a clear head, having mental models that will organize your thinking is half of your job. But the other half of your job is acquiring the skills, the abilities to practice what in the School of Public Policy we call the craft of governance. And that ranges from a very simple, learn how to write a good memo, to the very complicated, learn how to negotiate with Parliament. Communications, negotiation, leadership. If you're going to be a policymaker, those are the other half. The analytics, the quantitative, the economics are absolutely key, but they're not the whole job. They're only part of the job.
Thank you. My next question is, what are your favorite books and what books would you recommend to the undergraduate community at the LSE?
Well, in the vein of thinking about economics, in an applied sense, policy making, or the practical uses of economics. I thought about recommending two books, and then I realized that they both have the same title. Of course, one is alluding to the other. One of my favorite books, which I read very early on when I was thinking of doing economics as an undergraduate, is a book called The Worldly Philosophers, by an American economist called Robert Heilbronner. And this is basically a series of short biographical sketches of the great great economists in history, many of whom were also philosophers. Adam Smith was a philosopher. David Hume was a philosopher. Karl Marx was a philosopher. To some extent, John Maynard Keynes was a philosopher. And understanding how these thinkers came to do economics and how they combined research with practical life, policymaking, was fascinating. Ricardo was a stockbroker, not just an economist. Keynes, of course, was a professor at Cambridge, but also a government official. That book gives you that sense of how the philosophy, the economics, the practice, the policy design all come together. And a second book by the same title, a couple of years ago, maybe 3 years ago, an American historian at Princeton called Jeremy Adelman wrote a beautiful biography of one of my favorite economists, a German who was not quite the inventor of modern development economics, but but you know, a highly influential thinker. He taught at Harvard, taught at Columbia, and did a lot of research on developing countries everywhere. So I would say that, you know, if you read those two, you know, you could do a lot. You could do a lot worse. Oh, by the way, I didn't say the name of the subject of the biographer. Of course, that man is Albert Hirschman, the great development economist. So again, The Worldly Philosophers by Robert Heilbronner and Worldly Philosopher in singular, a biography of the great Albert Hirschman.
Thank you very much for the recommendation. And finally, something we ask every speaker we have over the podcast. What gives you hope?
What gives me hope? I think the fact that we can learn from our mistakes and do better next time around. Thinking about crises, thinking about the management of crises. What we learned, you know, I wasn't around, you weren't around, but what society collectively learned with the Great Depression and with many other smaller financial crises helped us contain the damage of the crisis 12 years ago. It was a great thing, for instance, that at the helm of the Federal Reserve, you had a man like Ben Bernanke who had spent his life studying the Great Depression. So he knew what he was doing when he took the Federal Reserve into uncharted waters. And then again, the policies that COVID applied, you know, that central banks and governments applied during COVID very much benefited from the experience, both the achievements and the pitfalls of fighting the world financial crisis 12 years ago. So yes, we human beings are not always rational. Yes, our politics nowadays tends toward the populistic and the crazy. However, in spite of all of that, we have the collective ability to learn and to do better. And that's a pretty good reason to be hopeful.
Thank you very much for your time, Professor.
My privilege. Thank you.
Thank you very much for listening. We want to thank Rita, Yunqing, and Ruby from the podcast team, Dr. Petroplu, Dr. Shapiro, and Alice Odonko from the Department of Economics for their support in the making of this episode. We hope you tune in next time.